Well, I got a call this week from Mark Winter about the family weekend, and he mentioned that so far they have about 500 rooms rented, and between the Clarion Hotel and the Holiday Inn. So he said there are going to be a lot of people there. He thinks maybe around 2,000. So going to be a lot of people there, and he told me I had 169 people signed up to play Speedway. And I'm like, and it's okay. The fact that they sign up is good, but there are more people than sign up always. So I'm like, okay, there are 169 plus maybe 40 or 50 more. So it'll be interesting to work them all in there. So that's a good thing that we have a lot of people, and encouraged and excited by that. So it'll be an interesting weekend, and be kind of like a mini feast here, the opportunity to be together with people you've met at the feast or friends. And so I'm looking forward to it, and we'll be down there next week and be enjoying that. And so I'll be busy for about 8 hours a day doing Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, doing football, flag football, and Speedway. So anyway, that's not bad duty. That's fun, and watching the kids have a good time. And so we'll look forward to being with friends, and my family's coming in there, so we'll look forward to seeing them down there as well. I think that, as a church, I think that has, over the 10 years we've had, it is encouraging to me to see what's going on in the church, and the church is growing, and there are people slowly being added to the church, and there are people being developed for leadership roles and going to take on responsibilities. I know there have been 71 people that have gone through the leadership program that they've had over the years in Cincinnati, and there will be more going through that. All that does is give them some exposure to some leadership. Doesn't mean they're going to be full-time ministers. Sometimes it's just a good training program for those who are able to attend over the Labor Day weekend. Now today I thought I would talk about something, and we're going to lead into it with William Shakespeare. Most of you have are aware of a play by William Shakespeare entitled Romeo and Juliet. Probably many of us, as we went to school, we had the opportunity to read through that play. I remember going through Romeo and Juliet somewhere in my high school career. I can't remember whether it was the beginning or the end, but somewhere along the way we read Romeo and Juliet. And it's an interesting story. It's about two rival families, and these families have a great deal of animosity toward one another for one reason or another. It's kind of like the Hatfields and McCoys, which is closer to where we live. It's just happening in a different part of the world, but those two families didn't get along. However, these two families that didn't get along had each family had a child. One was Romeo, one was Juliet. And Romeo and Juliet from these rival families met, they fell in love, and they got married. Now, these families didn't know they got married. In fact, they would be hostile to their getting married. And Juliet's father, not knowing that she was married, betrothed her to another man. And so Juliet is quite distressed by this, and she went to talk to a priest about the matter. And the priest told her, well, take this special potion, which is going to make you appear dead, and then it'll be useful in helping to work this out. So she takes the potion. And the potion's going to make her appear dead, but it's going to eventually wear off. Well, Romeo doesn't know anything about the special potion she's taken, so he comes up and he notices that she's dead, or he supposes she's dead. There's nobody to explain it, and he's just distraught, and he kills himself. And right after he kills himself, Juliet wakes up. And she notices that he's dead, and she kills herself as well. So it's a tragic story. And there are a number of lessons you can get from that particular play, but one of the lessons we're going to focus on is the fact that if Romeo had just waited a few moments longer, then Juliet would have awakened, and Romeo and Juliet's story may have worked out differently. They may have lived together happily ever after. But that's not the way it worked out, because Romeo could not wait any longer. He thought if the whole situation was worked out. And that's the challenge for all of us as God's people, is waiting. None of us like to wait. Waiting is something that is difficult for us. And when we find ourselves having to wait, what happens is we feel under a great deal of stress and pressure. And we have all sorts of things that go on in our lives that cause us to feel this weight of stress and pressure upon us as we try to wait on God. And that is a great challenge for us. And we have people facing lots of different things, lots of different challenges that they go through in life. We have young people that are looking for friends and boyfriends and looking for their place in the world, and they want things to work out. But it's hard for them to wait. It's hard for them to wait and let things work out the way God would want them to work out. We have people that are baptized in the church that would like to be married. And due to the dearth of what it seems like people who are eligible to be married, it's very frustrating. And it's a very hard thing for them to wait and trust that God would provide for them. We know that as members of the church, we face our own stresses and trials. And as we face those stresses and trials, what happens to us is that maybe there's somebody pressuring us to work on the Sabbath. They're subtly pressuring us. Maybe you can work a little bit here. Maybe you can work a little bit there, and pushing us toward that direction. And they're putting pressure on us. And the pressure is especially acute if we have the responsibility for a wife and children. We have to provide for them. And here we are. What are we going to do? Because if we get fired, jobs aren't all that easy to come by. What do we do? So we face these stresses and these pressures, and the people of God have always faced stresses and pressures, and we're going to face them from now on till the end of the age. And the question that we all have to ask ourselves as we face these various stresses is, will we wait on God? Will we wait on God? And what I'd like to do today is discuss the subject of waiting on God. It's an important subject for all of us, a subject that we have to consider as we go through our lives. Will we wait on God? And we can illustrate this in various ways. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at some individuals who had difficulty waiting on God. And we can learn certain things from their experiences. Now, the first one we want to look at is Abraham. Abraham was an individual who we know as the father of the faithful. And Abraham, as God called him out, brought him out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees, and then to Haran, and then on down to the land of Palestine, God told Abraham that he would have descendants as the sand of the sea. He would have many, many descendants. We go back to Genesis chapter 12, and we're familiar with this story. He says in Genesis chapter 12, 2, I will make you a great nation. And so that means that he's not just going to be a tribe or a clan, but he's going to be a nation with a vast number of people in it. So then Abraham takes to heart that that's what God's going to do, that God is going to make him a vast nation. And he goes on to tell Abraham later on that his descendants would be as the sand of the shore. You know, if you've ever been to the beach and looked at all those little fine grains of sand, that's a lot of sand, isn't it? He told him in another place that, you know, your descendants are going to be as the stars of heaven. And, you know, Israel's kind of a desert-like place, and if you've ever been out to the desert and been out there at night and looked up at the night sky, there's very little cloud cover to block your view. And you can just see the stars above you, and the number is vast. It's striking, the number of stars that are there. And so Abraham's thinking, you know, all these descendants, and the problem for Abraham was, okay, I'm ready to do this, And I'm looking forward to this, but you know what? Sarah and I don't have any children. When God had called Abraham out of Haran and they had moved to Palestine, he was 75 years old. And his wife was 65 and they had had no children. And so God makes this promise to Abraham, and he's looking forward to having a child with Sarah. And God keeps reemphasizing how many descendants he's going to have. And Abraham believed him that was what was going to come to pass. So Abraham, living in a society that allowed certain things, thought about, well, how is God going to solve this? How are we going to solve this? Obviously, God's going to fulfill his promise, but how is he going to do it? And the light bulb went on above his head. You know what? As you look at the society allows for Sarah to have a child through the handmaid. And that's how Abraham chose to resolve the problem. That must be a solution. That's a way that we can work this out. So he works this out and decides that, hey, this is a way that we can resolve this. And this is right after God renewed the covenant and told Abraham that he would have a child. And Abraham had waited a number of years. Remember I said he was 75 and he had a child, and it was a number of years later that he finally had a child. And so let's go to Genesis chapter 16. God in chapter 15 reemphasizes the fact that he will have children, and that Eliezer of Damascus would not be the one who would be his heir. In chapter 16, it says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, 'See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my handmaid.' So Sarah accepted this as well. 'Perhaps I shall obtain children by her.' And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan." So 10 years had passed. No child. Abraham had waited. Maybe this is the solution. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. And this was just the beginning of conflict. There was conflict between Sarah and Hagar. It continued on to the point where God said it's better that Hagar and Ishmael leave. And then eventually, God did give them a child. But how long did they have to wait? Abraham was 100 years old. And Sarah was 90. Pretty old to have a child. I mean, I can't imagine having a baby at 54. I mean, you know, there's a point where you've got, you're agile and you can put up with all that babies bring and all the effort you have to put into them. And you reach a certain point where it's like, grandchildren, that's the ticket. Because when you have grandchildren, hey, I had a good day with them, that's your kid, it's going back home because it's running me ragged here. You know, and you love them, but you can send them home because they tire you out. Little kids are busy. Little kids are busy. And we're not quite as busy as they are, but you got to keep an eye on them, and they're a pleasure, but at least you can say, I had a good day with you, come back tomorrow when I've recuperated, or a few days when I've recuperated. But the thing is, God fulfilled his promise, didn't he? But he didn't fulfill the promise in the time frame that they thought God would. And so they decided that they would resolve the problem. They didn't wait on God. And they had problems in their family from there on forward. And those problems between the descendants of Abraham, and the descendants of Isaac and Jacob, and the descendants of Ishmael continue to this day, don't they? If they had waited on God, you would have never had those conflicts. So sometimes you can begin a chain of events that impacts people for years and years down the road when you don't wait on God. Abraham is an example of that. Now, you go and look at another individual who didn't wait on God. And we know that Jacob was told, as before he was, it was told before he was born, that he would be preeminent over Esau. And God made certain promises that he would fulfill. But you're standing there looking at, now how is this going to work out? Because Esau is the firstborn. And Esau is going to receive the blessing and the birthright. I don't have any access to that because I'm born second. Now, Jacob, Esau didn't count his birthright as much. And so what did he do? He sold it cheap. Sold it cheap. And so that was legitimately Jacob's once he sold it. But the blessing was still his. And Jacob said, I want the blessing too. I want it all. And so he and his mother plotted in order to get the blessing, didn't they? And they got it. But at what price? At what price? The conflict between Jacob and Esau continues to this day as well. And the thing that you have to stop and look at is, we don't know how God would have worked it out, do we, if they had waited? But if they had waited on God, it was God's purpose to bestow those things upon Jacob, then God would have bestowed them upon Jacob in an honorable way. And because Jacob and his mother were unwilling to wait, we don't know how that would have worked out, do we? We don't know. But it would have worked out. It would have worked out in a way where everybody was blessed. It would have worked out in a way where everybody won. But they were unwilling to wait on God, and we find those conflicts between Jacob and Esau continuing to this day. There are historical recordings of how Esau sought to inflict lots and lots of vindictive actions upon Jacob. When Jacob was in trouble and they could take advantage of that, the descendants of Esau did. Now we go forward to in time to 1 Samuel. We look at another individual who could not wait on God. 1 Samuel. Now, First Samuel tells us about its primary focus is David. And we know David was not an individual who was outstanding in any particular way. He was from a mediocre family in the nation of Judah. But God chose him to be chose Saul to be king. And then he later on worked with David. And we'll get to David here in a bit. But we know that Saul was chosen to be king. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. And Saul was chosen to be king, and he was their first king. We know that was a bad decision by Israel to choose a king, but that's what they did. And Saul, as he was chosen to be king, was given certain, certain prophecies that were given that as Saul was made the king. And so a number of those prophecies, as they were given by Samuel, came to pass right away. But there was one prophecy that didn't come to pass right away. And that was the prophecy where God told Saul to wait 7 days. Not to make a wait for him 7 days and not to make a sacrifice until he came. So that prophecy was not fulfilled there in those passages where it talks about that. It all comes together and it seems like that's something that took place right away, but it didn't. And it's something that eventually came to pass. Now, we know that so Saul was supposed to wait, and somewhere along the way this prophecy was to come into play. Now, we know that in the circumstance where that worked out was where Saul was fighting the Philistines. The Philistines had invaded the country and Israel fled before the Philistines. They were overrunning the country, and Saul, as the king, was to lead the army out and defeat them. But the people were afraid of the Philistines. They had fled before them. And the army, what was happening with the army? The army was leaving as well. Slowly but surely, the army was dissipating. And Saul cannot go into battle until the sacrifice is made, and he's waiting on Samuel. So one day passes, no problem. But soldiers are leaving. 2 days pass, and soldiers are leaving. They're leaving, and the challenge is that Saul is becoming very fearful of what is taking place here. And so Saul eventually says, I can't wait any longer. The whole army is going to be gone, and I'm going to be overrun by the Philistines. And what does he do? He takes on the responsibility of the high priest, and he makes sacrifice. And what happens after he makes sacrifice? What happens to him after he makes sacrifice? Well, who shows up right after he does it? Samuel. Sure enough, almost as soon as he finishes, here comes Samuel. And did Saul know that he wasn't supposed to make this sacrifice? He did. He knew that he wasn't supposed to do that. And he comes out to Samuel, and what does Samuel say? He said, what have you done? What have you done? You have overstepped your bounds. That was not, you have no right or responsibility to make sacrifice, Saul. And so he had overstepped his bounds, and as a result of that, he said, your dynasty would have been established. But because you have done this, I am going to take your dynasty away. It says here in 1 Samuel chapter 13, it says, going through this story, it says in chapter 13 verse 8, it says, then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. Now, Samuel did come within the time period allotted. He just didn't come in the time period that Saul allotted. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering, something that only the priest was to do. Now it happened as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. As we face pressures in life, do we ever feel compelled to do something we shouldn't do? Saul felt compelled. He saw his army being overrun by the Philistines. Time had run out in his mind. But the thing is, does time ever run out for God? As you think about that, does time may run out in our mind, but does time ever run out for God? Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Physically speaking, did time run out for them? Sure did. God could intervene and stop this. Okay, he could keep Nebuchadnezzar from getting so upset. Hey, that's good. We want him not to be upset, but that's not the way it worked. He was mad. You're going to die. We're going to heat the furnace up 7 times more than normal, and we're going to throw you guys in there. So at any point along the way, God could have intervened, didn't he? And I'm sure that once they were bound and the soldiers were carrying them to the fire, they're thinking, looks like time is running out for us. And it did. Threw them in the fire. But the lesson that you get from Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego is this: time never runs out for God. It may run out physically speaking from a human perspective, but time never runs out for God. And God was able to preserve them through the fire. And they made it through. They waited on God. They had no other choice but to wait on God. And God mercifully intervened and preserved them, didn't He? And the same situation here is, as you look at Saul felt compelled to do something he shouldn't have done. He was under great stress. It says in verse 13, "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which He commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for Himself a man after His own heart. And the man has commanded him to be the commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you.'" And he said, you know what? You're going to continue as king, but your dynasty is not going to continue. It's going to die out. And I'm going to raise up somebody else who is a man after my own heart. So we see here that he felt compelled to break the commandment of God. And that's the challenge we all face as we are under stress and pressure in life is, will we wait upon God or will we take matters into our own hands and do what we think is right? In many cases, that involves the violation of God's law. Should we do it? How far do we compromise? We want to be married. So, do we marry outside the church? How far do we have to go to do that? Maybe we want to marry in the church. How far do we compromise our morals in order to get married? Maybe we just work a little bit on the Sabbath in order to keep our job. Or we just get that training on the Sabbath. Whatever it may be, in order to get what we want. Work it out the way we want instead of trusting in God. And that's the challenge we face here. We're talking about Saul being king. And it reminds us, brethren, that we have to wait on God. And sometimes we can't work it out. There's nothing. We can do everything we can try to do. And then it comes down to, God, I can't do anymore. It's in your hands. And we should try to do everything we can do within God's law. But then there's a point where you just can't do anymore. You just have to say, God, it's up to you. I've done all I can do, and I'm just going to have to wait on you. And that's how it does work out. But as you wait for God, it all works out. Now, we've looked at Abraham, and we've looked at Isaac and Jacob, and seen that some people didn't wait on God and the ramifications that come from that. But now coming into the story is an individual who waited on God. So Saul was the king, and Saul was and God said, I'm going to raise somebody else up. And so in 1 Samuel 16, we see Samuel going out to anoint David. And David, we're not exactly sure how old David was when he was anointed to be king. We figure he was a teenager, probably 14, 16, maybe 18 years old. We don't know exactly. But we do know that he was anointed to be the new king. And we know one of the first jobs that he had, and the interesting thing is, he's anointed to be king, and God puts him into an unusual circumstance because he says, you know what, Saul, you're going to have the future king working for you. And David, you're going to be working under the current king. So that sets up some interesting dynamics that we see worked out here. The first responsibility we see that David had was to play music for Saul. Saul had emotional problems. It says a distressing spirit in 1 Samuel 16. And David would play, and this would soothe Saul. And that was the first thing its first interaction that took place between Saul and David. And then we know that later on here in chapter 17, David kills Goliath. And as a result of David killing Goliath, then David began to serve in Saul's household in another capacity. And he was able to serve in Saul's house, and was a faithful servant to Saul for many years. It says in chapter 18, we see what's taking place here in chapter 18, chapter 5. So David went out wherever Saul went and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of the people, also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now it had happened as they were coming home when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines that the women had come out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul and tambourines with joy and with musical instruments. So we see here that Saul, the king, and David, who was in his service, defeated the Philistines. A great victory for Israel. And the people come out and they're rejoicing and singing here over this great victory that took place over the Philistines. In verse 7, so the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. So who did Saul want to be exalted here? I'm the king. I'm the person who should have all exaltation here. I'm the one that should get all of the laudatory comments. I should have songs sung about me. What are these people doing raising David up above me? Verse 8, then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? What does he see David as? A threat. A threat to his power. A threat to his being the king. A threat to his dynasty. And it says in verse 9, so Saul eyed David from that day forward. From that day forward, Saul kept an eye on him and he looked at him with jealousy. This fellow is a threat to me and to my dynasty. And verse 10, and it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul. And he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, I will pin David to the wall with it. But David escaped his presence twice. So he tries to kill him. Tries to pin him to the wall twice. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul is so threatened here and so desirous of maintaining power that he's willing to kill to maintain that power. I'll get rid of this person who's a rival to me. When David apparently, David is let's say he's an anointed king at 16, he's not going to assume the kingship of Israel for 14 years. It's a long time to wait. And people apparently knew that he was to become king, and Saul knew it and saw him as a threat. He says that God's spirit had departed from him, and he saw that the Lord was with David. And this irked him because when Saul first began to be king, God had worked with him and he knew what that was like. And now he found himself in a situation where God was no longer working with him. But he could very clearly see that God was with David. And again, it just fed his jealousy. Verse 13, so Saul takes action. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. Remember back to verse 5, it said that he was placed over the men of war, a much higher position. And now he's being demoted and made a captain over 1,000. So what did David do? How did David react? How dare you demote me from being captain over all of your men in war to this lowly position of being over 1,000? How dare you do that? David didn't do that. He took the demotion in a positive way. It says he went out and came in before the people. He continued doing his job. And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him, Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. David didn't act rashly. He did what he was supposed to do. He continued to serve. Verse 16, but all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before him. He did what he was supposed to do. And even though Saul hates him, is jealous of him, and wants to kill him, God still gave him favor before the people. We know that eventually Saul began to persecute David. And in chapter 19, now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, my father seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. We see that Saul was after him, and there was really no escape. And it says in chapter 19, verse 18, so David fled and escaped and went to Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him, and he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. And we know that eventually David had to flee, that he could no longer stay in his presence. And this was a very distressful time for him. Why am I being treated this way? I've only been loyal to him, and yet he's trying to kill me. I'm not trying to take the kingship away from Saul. I'm letting God work that out. But Saul's out to kill him, and he went to Samuel and he said, well, what can you tell me? What can I do? What action should I take? And Samuel, it doesn't tell us what Samuel said, but apparently he was told to flee. And sometimes when you're in a conflict, that's all you can do. You can't raise your hand against the person in authority, so the best thing is just to get out of the way. And that's what David did. Let's go back to Psalm chapter 13, which we'll go back to the story of David and Saul. But in Psalm chapter 13, sometimes, you know, David in the Psalms is reflecting on the experiences that he had. And in Psalm chapter 13, you know, as you think about what he was going through with Saul, it may apply in the situation in which David finds himself. Psalm 13, beginning in verse 1. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? You know, God, you anointed me to be king. You put me in the position to serve under Saul, and my life has been miserable. I'm a hunted man. And I'm not so worried about being king's one thing, but surviving is another. How long are you going to forget me? It's been years since I was anointed king, and this is a very stressful life. How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? And David was his enemy. Or not David, but Saul was David's enemy. How long would he be exalted over him? Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Enlighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed against him. Lest those who trouble me rejoice when I am moved. How long will I go along here? And he pours his heart out to God in an appeal. But then, you know, David, you know, expresses those heartfelt emotions. And we all feel such emotions. Well, how long do I have to go through this trial? Whatever it may be. And it's very stressful. And so what does he finally say in verse 5? He says, but I have trusted in your mercy. Ultimately, God, you will be merciful. Ultimately, God, the stress that I'm under will be relieved. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. The salvation from the trial and salvation ultimately in God's kingdom. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. So we know that David had these very heartfelt emotions because of the stresses that he was under. We know that ultimately David had to flee, and He made a pact with Jonathan that he would not that Jonathan would not attack David's family and David would not attack his family. And so then David went out and began to just try to stay out of the way of Saul. Now time went on, and we know there were a couple of circumstances in which God put Saul into David's hand. Now, do you think God allowed this for a reason? Do you think he was seeing if David would wait on him? David was to be king. Maybe God's working it out this way. Remember, he was in the cave, and there's Saul using the bathroom. He's kind of in an inconvenient situation. I can just kill him right here. Perfect. He walked right into the cave, and I'm in here. God's given him into my hand. But David said, no, we can't. We cannot do that. He did cut off a piece of his garment, didn't he? Showing, hey, I'm close. But this other example we're going to look at in 1 Samuel 26 is interesting. In chapter 26, verse 1, now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is David not hiding in the hill of Hakilah, which is opposite Jeshimon? So he's saying, hey, the people around here are against him, turning him in. So the Ziphites turn him in. And so Saul comes out there after him. It says in verse 5, so David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp with the people encamped all around him. Then David answered and said to Abimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. And Abishai was kind of a mountain of a man. If you wanted a guy on your side in a fight, you wanted Abishai on your side. At one point, Abishai fought 300 men and killed them all. I'd say, that's the guy I want fighting with me, okay? So he was quite a warrior. So he went down with David. He said, sure, I'll go with you. Verse 7, so David and Abishai came to the people by night. And there Saul lay sleeping within the camp with his spear stuck in the ground by his head. And Abner and the people lay all around him. So they march right into the camp. And Saul's laying there. And his spear is right by his head. And then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. Let me take the spear up, and I'll drive it clean through his head, right into the ground, and this will all be over. And the spear's right there. Saul's laying there. Nobody is rousing. And David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? I don't have the right to raise my hand against him. David said, furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. Hey, he could die of natural causes. God could take his life. He could go out to battle and die. There are a number of ways in which he could die. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But let's take the spear and his jug of water and let us go. Let us know that we were close, but we intended him no harm. So David had, and as you go down to the end of the chapter, it says that God put a special sleep on all the soldiers here. You know, you wonder, well, where are the sentries? And nobody heard these guys creeping into camp. Nobody saw them. God made sure they were dead asleep. They didn't hear anything. And the situation was perfect where he could have killed Saul, and he didn't. He didn't kill him. But they took the spear, they took the jug of water, and they left. Because he said, I have no right to do that. David chose to wait on God. David chose to wait on God. Now, let's go to back a little further here. We see a situation where David didn't wait on God so well. He was in a situation where, living out in the wilderness, one of the things that they did while they were out there is there was a man by the name of Nabal. And Nabal was a wealthy farmer, a wealthy herder. And he was prospering. He was living like a king. And David, being out there, protected Nabal's sheep herders and goat herders and make sure that they were all taken care of and watched over. And they protected them with their armed force. And so when the time came for the harvest, David said, well, maybe Nabal will give us some of his bounty. And they went up and asked. And Nabal rejected him. Didn't just reject him, but made fun of him. Scoffed at the request. So David's men came back and said, well, here's what he said. And David was enraged. He was just outraged that this man whom they had served would act like that. So what did he do? He said, mount up, boys. We're going to go kill this guy. We're going to kill him, his family, and just wipe out everything. He was pretty angry. But fortunately, Nabal had a wise wife. And she said, somebody explained to her what took place and that the soldiers had left and they were unhappy. And she thought, this isn't going to turn out well. So she got a bunch of food together and loaded it all up. And they marched out and they met David. And they talked to David. She talked wisely to David and said, you don't want to do this. I'm married to Nabal. The name fits the man. Fool. And the thing is, we just have to realize who he is and what he's like. And the thing is, you don't do this because it's going to come back to haunt your kingship if you do. So obviously she knew he was to become king. It must have been people knew that ultimately he was to become king. And he listened to her, and probably his men are saying, let's get him. We'll wipe them out and it won't take us any time at all. We'll have everything. And David said, wisdom prevailed. And he said, you know what? This isn't the wise action to take. And he chose not to kill Nabal. And rather than acting rashly, impetuously, which we can do, we can end up really hurting ourselves. But if we wait on God, it tends to work out. Now, as you think about David was a man who worshipped God and was faithful to God. And we see that he did wait on God for the kingship, but he wasn't perfect in every way. And what we have to realize as God's people is that it is a great challenge for us to wait on God, isn't it? It's not easy for us to wait on God, but it's something that we have to do. We have to trust that God is going to work things out in His time and in His way. And we don't always know how He's going to do that, do we? We don't always know that. For instance, as you think about a number of different subjects, one of the subjects that we might think about is the gospel. You know, we've been in the church, and as a church, as we look at things today, how many new people are coming to church? Not many. Are we preaching the gospel? We are. But there's not a whole lot of growth at this point in time. And we might say, well, why even keep doing it if there's no growth? Well, the thing is, as you go back and you look at when Mr. Armstrong began to preach the gospel in 1934, how much did the church grow in the first 10 years? Very little. Very little. In fact, for the first 20 years, the church didn't grow hardly at all. It was called the Radio Church of God because that's what it primarily was, a radio church. You didn't have churches in very many areas at the time. But then in the mid-1950s, about 20 years after things began, the church began to grow. Now, we've been at it 10 years. Now, we're ahead of the game because we've learned a lot of things from Mr. Armstrong's time to now. We don't have to completely reinvent the wheel. But the thing is, we haven't grown much. It comes in God's time.
it comes in God's time. So do we quit? Or do we say, you know what, we still have a job to do and we need to continue doing it, and in God's time, we will grow. We will grow. In all facets of God's church and God's work, we will grow if we wait on God. And what stresses do we face in our life? What stresses do we face in our life that we feel great stress and pressure about? What we have to realize is God's there. And God is going to see us through, and God is going to provide for us, and God will provide a way in which we can work things out. But we have to wait for Him, and that's hard to do. But the thing is, we know what's right and wrong, don't we? So if we keep choosing to do what's right as we're under that stress, then God will help it to work out the right way. You know, as it works out, the one thing we don't want are consequences, do we? You know, who wants more conflicts down the road and things that like going on between Esau and Jacob? We don't want that. We don't want the difficulties between Ishmael and Isaac, do we? We don't want those kind of conflicts. We want it to work out in the best way and the long-term results to be good, too. Isn't that what we want? And as we wait on God, it will work out that way. As we hold fast to the principles that God has given to us, it will work out that way. Now let's go to Psalm chapter 27. Psalm chapter 27. As we conclude. Let's begin in Psalm 27, verse 7. It says, "Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. Have mercy also upon me and answer me. When you said, 'Seek my face,' my heart said to you, 'Your face, Lord, I will seek.'" And that's what we have to persist in doing, is seeking the face of God, seeking that relationship with God. And you know, in my experience over the years, the desire to work it out the way you want sometimes becomes very compelling. And it is very hard to wait. Sometimes, you know, you want to take the precipitous action. This will solve it. It may. But there may be lots of ramifications from it. And sometimes you've just had to say, you know what? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do in this situation. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just wait. I'm just going to wait. And eventually, it'll sort itself out. Something will happen, and it will make it clear what to do. But you're waiting. And you know what? The whole time you're waiting, and whatever problem it is that you're dealing with is always on your mind. It's always there. It's always bothering you. You're always thinking about it. And you're constantly turning it over. You're constantly turning it over, thinking about, now how am I going to work this out? And the answer is, I don't know. And God hasn't shown you what to do. And God doesn't, you know, there's no Urim and Thummim, and you can ask the Urim and Thummim a question and it lights up. There is no voice that's going to talk to you and say, "Hey, do this." That's not going to happen. But somehow, some way, there will be something come up that will make it clear, and this is the action that I should take. And as you take that action, it ends up being the most positive step that you could take in working something out. So we want to continue to seek God's face. And it says in verse 9, "Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away in your anger. You have been my help. Do not leave me nor forsake me, O God of my salvation." We need God at every turn. We need His help at every turn. "When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me." And that's a hard thing to deal with if your own parents forsake you. Your own parents maybe turn you in or turn their back on you for one reason. But he said, "You will take care of me." Even though that severe action takes place, you'll be there for me. I can count on you. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me in a smooth path because of my enemies. How many of you want a difficult path? Probably all of us want a smooth path. Show us, see, God's path is a smooth path. And as we choose to go down His path, in His time and in His way, it's going to be the smoothest. And if you've ever, gone out hiking, which I'm going to do more of, if you're on a rough trail, it's your ankles twist every which way, and you're stepping over this and around that. You know, if you're on a smooth trail, it's pretty pleasant. Kind of maybe there's an incline to it, but it's pretty smooth. It's easier to walk along, isn't it? And that's what he's asking God to give him, is a smooth path. Show me that path. Do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and such as breathe out violence. I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. You know, sometimes what we face is so overwhelming and discouraging that we come close to losing heart. We come close to losing heart. Let's go back to Hebrews and just keep your finger there in Psalm 27. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 10. The Hebrews, it doesn't tell us what kind of stresses they were facing, but the Hebrews that Paul is addressing in the book were facing stress. They were facing difficulties, and they were pretty discouraged. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 35. And Paul is seeking to encourage them, and he says in verse 35, "Therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward." How long have you run the race? Are you going to give it up? You put in years and years of work and time on your knees and study, and you've tried to do it, but something is so hard for you to deal with that you're just like, I'm going to just chuck it all. I'm going to walk away. I'm going to compromise with this for some reason. You know, as you think about that, what are you walking away to? He says, "Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward," because the reward's still real. It's still going to be there. And he says, "For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise." You may just have to suck it up and keep going. Say, you know what? I know that if I keep putting one foot in front of the other, eventually I'll get there. I may not be moving at a very fast pace, but I'm going to keep lifting one foot and putting it out and putting the other one up after it. And eventually, I'll get there. You need endurance. And the trials and things that we go through along the way remind us, brethren, that, you know what? I remember back when I had a trial and I got through it. You see, I've run about 2 3/4 marathons. One, I didn't make it. The body in Albuquerque just said, you can't do it anymore. You're done. And so I had to quit. But I made 2 of them. So from that, I know that I can walk a long way if I want to. I may be tired, but you know I've done it before, and you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And the fact that you know you made it tells you, I can do this now. It's going to hurt. I don't want to do it, but I can do it. And the things that we go through as we face trials in our life, what is to remind you of? You know what? I went through a trial before. I went through something and I made it. I took every step through that and I made it. And it's to remind you that you can persevere and you can make it. You can make whatever it is that you're required to do. For you have need of endurance so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. See, you have to do the will of God to receive the promise. Not your will, no matter how much stress you're under. Verse 37, "For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry." You see, you may give in. You give in. And what a terrible thing to give in and throw it away and Christ returns. Just like Romeo and Juliet. If you'd hung on a little while longer, it would have broke your way. But you gave up. And Christ returns. What do you have? Not much. Now if the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. We're dedicated to finishing this. No matter how far it is, we're going to take every step and we're going to complete the mission that we've started. And then sometimes it seems like we are about to lose heart, but we know that God is there and He's with us. And finally, in verse 14, the thing that we always need to remember is this. Wait on the Lord. Wait on the Lord. Be of good courage, and He shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. And I think that says it all, that we should wait on the Lord. So please remember that if you would like to help out with the flowers to meet Nola Whitlow up here up front, and she'll work that out, or sign the list on the back. And then we'll go ahead and eat, and we'll try to begin our class about 1:30. So we'll give us time to fellowship, give us time to relax a little bit, and then we'll have the class beginning at 1:30.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We have one more opportunity to sing, so if you'd all take your hymnals and write.